connecting to the real nerds is so easy. You can go to our website, realnerdspodcast.com. You can like us on Facebook. We have a Twitter account, at Real Nerds. We also have Instagram. You can call us, 720-6NERDS5. You want to email us? You can do that too, realnerds@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Welcome to Denver Comic Con 2016. We have a fantastic interview lined up for you. Enjoy.
All right, we are live here on the floor at Denver Comic Con. It's day three. We're getting to the end of the day. It's starting to wrap up here. And I'm here with Rich. Rich, we've been trying to figure out how to get with you because you started telling us a little bit about what you've done in your life, and we were like, this sounds amazing. So you've worked at a number of movie theaters, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Go back to 1966.
Wow.
And I worked continuously in the industry for about 35 years doing just about everything you can imagine in the industry.
Wow.
It's not so much now because I've been at it for a while,
yeah,
and there's a lot of newer theaters now, but there was a point in time where probably I had my fingers on about half the theaters in Denver.
Wow.
In one way, shape, or form.
So what are some of the most fun theaters in Denver that you got to work at?
Well, fun is an interesting term.
I think
the ones that I've enjoyed the most is I ran the Ogden for a few years.
Oh, very
when that
cool.
was a motion picture theater.
Yeah.
I ran it right after it was remodeled.
Yeah.
I've been involved with some major projects. Like, for example, I helped open up the IMAX theater at the museum.
Oh, God.
I was involved with the startup for the IMAX theater on the Colorado Center Theater.
Yeah.
So those are fun projects because you're doing something new and different.
Yeah.
The IMAX theater at the museum was highly experimental. I mean, basically, they hired me to go in and say, okay, we're going to have this system in the theater. We want it to be successful. Let's figure out how to make it work, but it doesn't have to be a regular movie theater.
Right.
So let's just go with it and see what works. So that was fun because it was a highly experimental situation.
So were you working on just the projection system, or
did
you help design
no,
like
no,
the whole
I was
theater
the general manager.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
So I was involved with everything. I oversaw the marketing, oversaw the logistics, how the theater operated, everything.
Okay, fascinating. It's funny, that's a theater that I have adored my entire life, to be completely honest with you. It's one that, as a little kid, I can still remember going to see, like, Everest and some of the other, you know, 90s IMAX films. And the amazing experience that you get in that theater because of the sheer size of that theater and the way that the seats are laid out, that you get those big sweeping shots, the helicopter shots, and the way, I mean, you genuinely feel like the whole theater is moving.
Yeah, that was a fascinating project because I think that theater was built in 1983.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, IMAX was basically a museum or amusement park exhibit.
Right.
That is to say, the preceding theaters were, with very few exceptions, just a room in an existing museum.
Oh, okay.
Denver was really kind of an experiment.
Really?
It was the first, and I won't call it a freestanding theater because it's attached to the museum on
right.
one side.
Yes. But it's not included in another exhibit.
Right. It was designed so that in the evenings when the museum was closed, it could operate as a freestanding theater.
Right.
And that was a radical experiment at its time. And in fact, we were running two films back to back because we wanted to create a destination theater that people would want to go to and watch a film on their own. Well, the problem at that point in time is most IMAX films were 20 minutes long.
Yeah.
Not worth making a trip across town for. So we actually had to put together a pre-show, and then we'd run like a shorter film and a little bit longer film back to back and create a full program.
Interesting.
And at that point in time, everyone said, this isn't going to work.
Huh.
Everyone said to us, no, IMAX can never be anything more than just an exhibit in a museum. People aren't going to go just to see an IMAX show. Well, not only did we prove that wrong, that became, at that time, the most successful IMAX theater in the world.
Wow.
So it was really a radical experiment today. Now we kind of take it for granted because IMAX has since moved into commercial film.
Yeah.
And like at the IMAX Theater in Colorado Boulevard, they have a dedicated auditorium for IMAX.
Right.
And that auditorium, by the way, wasn't originally dedicated for IMAX. It was built for IMAX. It was designed to IMAX specs.
Oh, okay.
But United Artists didn't have a relationship with IMAX at that point in time. The builder, the developer for that center,
yeah,
wanted to have a large format theater of some kind. He wanted to have something special. And so they incorporated that in the design of that particular auditorium. But at that point in time, UniArts really didn't know what to do with it. And they asked me to come in. And we did a couple of special 70mm presentations, because that was really my specialty, was large format film presentations and doing presentation theaters. And then after a few years, they said, okay, we're ready to try some IMAX. And Buena Vista was pushing IMAX at that point in time because they did Fantasia 2000 in IMAX.
Yes, I remember that.
And that was a big deal. And so our theater said, okay, let's go ahead and install the equipment. Let's run it as an IMAX theater and see what happens. So that was what I was involved with. And up until then, it just was never did IMAX.
Yeah.
Now it does IMAX constantly. So that's one of the ways in which even just that one system has evolved over the years.
So, I mean, the IMAX projectors, anybody who doesn't realize, are obviously these massive projectors. But because they were a smaller company, were those early machines at that time, were they particularly difficult to work with? I don't want to say a jalopy, or was it like you were working with scientific equipment that you had these giant machines?
It wasn't high tech in the sense of working with and running the equipment.
Yeah.
It was high tech in the sense of the technology behind designing the equipment.
Sure.
But obviously you bought the equipment, so that was already solved for you. But no, they're not that much more difficult to run. The trick with IMAX is that you have to be a little bit more careful in terms of your handling large pieces of film, 70mm film, run horizontally, which means 15 perf rather than 5 perf 70.
Yeah.
But also, because you're projecting so large on the screen, every little flaw is magnified.
Oh.
So it requires more care on the projections part to make sure that everything's right. And, of course, we're selling quality. And so all the way down the stream, your staff has to be trained that the things that might slip by in another theater aren't going to slip by here.
Yeah.
So that was basically our philosophy. I mean, people were always surprised with when we opened the theater, because if something wasn't just right, and it might have been something that many customers would not have noticed, but we would give people passes on the way out and say, hey, we made a boo-boo, because we needed to make sure that everything was absolutely perfect.
Fascinating. Very cool. I had no idea that Denver was that radical. You know, I just, like you said, I took it for granted my whole life just because I grew up here and didn't realize that was something not everyone had. Were you involved at all in the new planetarium they put in as well?
I was not involved with the planetarium. I worked with a lot of the people that are involved with the planetarium.
Oh, okay.
But Gates Planetarium was a different department for
right.
me.
Yeah. I was just curious because, of course, IMAX was doing those OmniMax things as well.
Yeah, OmniMax was an interesting story. IMAX came first, and there was actually a museum director out in San Diego who had a planetarium. And it was his idea, not IMAX's idea, to take this projection system and project it onto a dome rather than a flat screen.
Yeah.
So that's how that evolved. And now there's what they call OmniMax theaters, which is basically IMAX projected onto a dome.
Yeah.
Oh, I think throughout the world. But that was the genesis of that.
Oh, that's very cool. So switching gears entirely, when you were working in traditional theaters like the Ogden, how did you get involved in that? I assume you started there before you went into IMAX.
Oh, I started when I was in college just being an usher in a theater.
Yeah.
When I got started, it was a very, very different industry than it is now. For example, almost every theater had ushers. And I was hired as an usher, and I had to work my way up to being a doorman to take tickets. You had to have experience to do that.
Yeah, not just anybody can rip a ticket.
No, so it was very different back then. Of course, back then, there was a lot more emphasis on the type of theaters and the way they were run.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the theaters in the era compared to the era now, and they're radically different.
Yeah.
Of course, we came off, there's really several, many different eras of motion picture theaters. You, in the 30s, you had the movie palaces, the grand movie palaces,
right.
Most of which have been torn down around the country.
Yeah.
Paramount Theater in Denver is actually a very low-grade example of what movie palaces were. And then along came the atmospheric theaters. And then in the 50s, when Cinerama became popular, you started seeing variations of cinema like 70mm, and that's when the presentation theater started developing, what I call the presentation theaters, which were theaters that were built to show 70-millimeter reserve seats and all that.
Right.
So all those have been torn down, or most of those have been torn down, so you don't see that anymore. So it's a very different industry now than it was back then.
It's a really cool thing every now and then when you get to walk in. I was just recently in San Francisco, where Alamo Drafthouse renovated the Mission, which is an old theater that is absolutely beautiful. I mean, their main theater is one of those where you walk in and the walls are all ornate. And, you know, it was originally built as a play theater and was then converted at one point into a movie theater. And it's just beautiful. And it's a totally different experience seeing a movie in one of those places because you're sort of immersed in the idea of you going to the movie as an event, right? You talk about the ushers and the doorman and all that stuff. Like, it was supposed to sort of duplicate the feeling of going to see a play locally, right? Like, you were supposed to feel that same sort of sense of
that was it, exactly.
Event.
That really came from Michael Todd. Hmm. Michael Todd was one of the partners involved with Cinerama. They brought him in because they wanted someone with a theater background. And Michael Todd at that time was both produced live theater in addition to making movies.
Yeah.
And so his idea was, hey, let's make Cinerama something special by having reserved seats and doing performances with intermission and the whole ball of wax. Well, then 70mm was really created to compete with Cinerama, although it was nowhere near as expansive as Cinerama. Well, at that point in time, people said, well, let's take some of those ideas and incorporate them into these theaters that we were building for 70mm.
Yeah.
So that's where that whole concept really evolved from. In fact, when I was involved with the IMAX theater at the museum, that was kind of my inspiration too. We wanted to be more of an experience.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember clear as day that feeling of, you know, you always had to wait in line before you got in, and they ushered everybody in, and then they had that sort of preview setting video where the woman would at the end, she'd say, "Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the IMAX experience." And I always thought it was so impressive. And it also really intimidating as a kid when they told you, like, if you leave, you can't come back. And then I was afraid that I was going to ruin the experience.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a really big deal back then. You know, what people don't realize is back in, I guess what you might call the golden age of movies now, back in the 30s,
right,
in the era of the movie palaces, those movie palaces frequently sat as many as 5,000 people.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about this for a second, you've got a huge logistics problem because you've got a lot of people coming in and leaving in a short period of time, and you've got to move 5,000 people very efficiently. Now, on top of that, you want to create this movie palace experience, because in those days, movie was really escapism. The type of movies that were made to be more escapist. And in addition, the idea in those days is people didn't have that much money.
Right.
So a theater was someplace they could go and they could feel glamorous for a day.
Yeah.
You know, they could go in, they spend their evening there, and it was lush surroundings, and it was something that they didn't have at home.
Yeah, it was like commoditizing the special events that rich people were going
to.
Yeah.
So you had a logistics problem on one hand with 5,000 people coming in, and an atmosphere problem on the other hand, where you need to make them all individually feel special.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So when did you work your way into projection? And how did you know, like, this is the part I love?
Well, like I say, I started off as an usher, got promoted to doorman, became an assistant manager, just worked my way up in the business.
Yeah.
My actual background was in art. I was studying commercial art in college.
Oh, wow.
So at one point, everyone said, well, we need someone that can do ads. Get that kid. So that's when I went into advertising. I ran the in-house advertising agency for a theater chain for a number of years, and then went back into theater operations. I've done literally everything in theater. One of the things as a manager of a theater is you need to know it all.
Yeah.
So you better know how to run that projector. If there's a problem with the projections, or if someone needs to train the projections, you better know everything that goes on in that theater. I mean, I've cleaned theaters, I've run projectors in theaters, I've done ads for theaters, you name it.
Yeah.
But that's just part of the territory.
Are there any films that you've screened over the years that you really, like, hold dear as, like, oh, man, I remember getting to show people that movie or this movie, and that were, for you, really special, memorable moments?
Oh, name the movie. I'll give you an example. Okay, a lot of the people here are wearing Star Wars costumes or You know, there's a lot of exhibits built around Star Wars.
Absolutely.
There's a Spiro exhibit across the hall.
Right.
Well, let's talk about Star Wars for a second. I remember
of course.
When that first opened up, I was managing the Century 21, which was a big deluxe presentation theater on Colorado Boulevard.
Okay.
About three or four blocks south of the Cooper Theater, okay. which originally was built to be a special theater for Cinerama.
Oh, okay, cool.
And then, of course, when Cinerama died, they started just running films in 70mm.
Right.
Well, I remember 3 months before Star Wars opened, because I was also a theater manager, we were starting to get publicity material for Star Wars. We get stills and things like that, and I was going, oh, this looks so cool. Because I was a big science fiction fan, too.
Yeah.
So the day before Star Wars opened up to the public in Denver at the Cooper Theater down the street, they had a special industry preview. And because I was in the industry, I got tickets for the preview. Interestingly enough, ironically enough, half the people in the industry did not use their tickets.
No.
They did not have a full house because no one believed that science fiction film was going to do anything. Everyone thought it was going to be a big flop in the industry.
Right.
And the theater was only about half full. And I can remember coming afterwards, and I was just really psyched out. This is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I was talking to the district manager for that theater chain, which was our competitor at that time.
Yeah.
And he says, maybe it'll run for 6 weeks or something like that. It's not going to be that big of a deal. And, of course, the next morning, first show, they were sold out. Didn't know what hit them.
Wow.
It was a surprise to everybody in the industry.
Man. Well, where were you working when Jaws came out?
I'm sorry?
Where were you working when Jaws came out?
When Jaws came out, I was managing the Century 21 Theater. Jaws opened up at the Continental Theater in Denver, which was, again, another presentation house. The Continental Theater was actually built for a competing film format to Cinerama called D150, which is another huge widescreen format. Well, there are only, two or four films ever made in that format.
Yeah.
So it kind of died. So they went back into running just regular 70mm films and then eventually commercial films, 35mm films. And Jaws played at the Continental Theater.
Yeah.
I remember sitting in the last row of the preview of Jaws, and the woman in front of me was so scared, she threw her popcorn in the air, and it all landed on top of me.
That's funny. Because, you know, you hear the stories about Jaws, which is now credited as being, like, the birth of blockbuster films. Because at the time, at least what I'm told, is that before that, you know, in the summer, that wasn't really when you had your big blockbuster movies, right? Your big films.
There were blockbusters. If you look at the history of film, there's always been blockbusters. There's always been spectacles. It goes back to Gone with the Wind.
Oh, absolutely.
Gone with the Wind was a spectacle of its day. Of course, they didn't have a lot of techniques for special effects.
No.
But like The Burning of Atlanta, that was the spectacle.
It was an event. Everybody had
event.
To see it.
Yeah. And that was like a 2.5, three-hour long movie.
Right.
So it was more of an event.
Yeah.
So if you study the history of film, that has always been with us.
Right.
It's just that the type of event or the type of spectacle has evolved over the years and changed. Now, when Jaws came out, at that point in time, every film played in one theater in Denver. And the competition for theaters in that era was to get the big movie.
Oh.
If you got a good big film, like a Jaws, for example, that the industry term was had a lot of legs to it, you could run that film all summer, maybe even all year. You know, what people forget is there were films like, for example, Sound of Music ran at the Aladdin Theater for 2 years.
Yeah.
It was a reserved seat thing. It was a special event. And these films had long, long runs, but they only played in one theater.
Yeah.
And then maybe at the end of a year or 6 months, whenever the film played out in that theater, then it would go out to the neighborhood theaters for a double feature run of some kind. And then it was played out. One of the ways in which the industry has changed is that studios realized, probably in the 70s and 80s, that they were putting a lot of money, you know, tens of millions of dollars in the production of these films.
Yeah.
They're paying interest on that money.
Right.
So they wanted to get that money back as fast as they could. So they said, well, we're not willing to play this film in one theater and wait to get that return. We want to play it in more theaters than just one.
Yeah.
Well, the trend started in New York City because that was such a huge population base where they would do what was called showcasing the film. And showcasing the film meant it played in 3 or 4 or 5 different theaters simultaneous to each other rather than one theater exclusively. Mm. Well, eventually, over the years, that spread all over the country. And now you see films that open up and they'll play in virtually every theater in Denver.
Right.
They'll play in 15 or different locations. And not only will they play in 15 different locations, but because these are all multiplex theaters, they might play it in three or four screens in the same theater.
Right.
To maximize the seating capacity. And that's all driven by the studios wanting to get that money back as fast as possible.
Yeah, which what that's done is it's like you said, it's shortened the legs on a movie.
Exactly.
Which then also means that they need to release a movie every quarter or twice a quarter, because they got, as soon as the legs on one movie that they made is done, they need another one in the theater, and so you're getting a lot more films than you used to get as well.
That's exactly the way the industry has changed. You know, there's a time where the most profitable film for a theater was this, what they would call a sleeper film, which is a really good film that maybe didn't capture the people's imagination right away. But you'd play it for 3 or 4 or 6 weeks in the theater, and word of mouth would get out, and people would hear about it, and all of a sudden it would run for a year.
Yeah.
Because people would just kept coming. Now they don't have that opportunity. If you don't catch it, and that, you know, one of the things people don't realize is when they hear about, well, this film has a budget of $150 million. Well, what you don't understand is that maybe $40 or $50 million of that budget is for marketing and advertising, because they have to really push the movie up front. Because if it doesn't catch on the first week or two, it's dead. It's gone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, and especially they've... I'd be interested to know if this was true back in the day. Now the way that they get paid is that the longer the movie is in the theater, the larger portion that the theater actually gets of the ticket sale, right? So if it's, you know, in the first week, the majority of the money goes back to the studio, and then the longer it's in the theater, the more the theater actually makes on it. So theaters actually love the movies that are sleeper hits.
That's exactly the point. That's why they love to have sleepers.
Right.
Because that's when they made their money, was on the back end. Film deals tend to be on a sliding scale. And in fact, usually they're like a sliding scale with some money up front.
Yeah.
So you're paying let's say, and I'm going back a few years before I've been involved with film buying.
Yeah.
So 15 years ago, a typical deal for a big film might be $150,000 guarantee against 90% of the box office the first week, and maybe 80% for the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Well, if the film was a total bomb, you were out that $150,000.
Man.
On the other side of the coin, you really didn't make money until the 5th or 6th or 7th week of the film.
Right.
When the percentages got low enough that it was a more of a fair shake for the theaters.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is what drives admission concession prices.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, this honestly, I feel like I could talk to you all day, Rich, but this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for coming by.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
It's really cool to get to talk to somebody who's like lived this stuff.
Well, it's fun because I've seen so much change. It's so different now from what it used to be.
Oh,
and that's made it really fascinating to talk about.
It's going to continue to change for a while, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for coming by.
You bet. And
this has been great.
Thank you so much for listening to this exclusive interview from Real Nerds Podcast at Denver Comic Con 2016. I'd like to thank Denver Comic Con and Pop Culture Classroom for giving us this opportunity. Thanks. Bye.
Real Nerds is a Nebulous Visions multimedia production. We would also like to thank Sparks Mandrill for our music. Additional music from Ben Sounds. Thank you to Alamo Drafthouse. Thank you to Colorado Coins, Cards, and Comics. And thank you for listening to the Real Nerds Podcast.